Good evening. I want to welcome you all to the first in the WordCraft Circle of Native Writers series of visiting speakers for this year. WordCraft Circle is also supported here at the university by the American Indian Studies program. I'm Malia Powell. I'm a faculty member in Writing Rhetoric in American Cultures and in American Indian Studies, and I'm here to introduce Leanne Howe. Before I do, I wanted to just mention to you one other event that American Indian Studies is sponsoring in the upcoming weeks. On October 25th, it's a Saturday, from 1 to 7 p.m. in Erickson Kiva, there's going to be a Native American dance showcase featuring Native people from Michigan and lots of fine folks and fun. So if you have some time, you should come by. We'd love to see you there. I got asked to introduce Leanne for a number of reasons. She's in my field, she's someone I know, she's someone whose writing I really, really love. And it's difficult to introduce somebody who you know really well. And so I'm gonna try to stick to the official story. Leanne Howe is an enrolled member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. She has been and done many things. She's been a student at Oklahoma State, an MFA student at Vermont College, a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, a bond trader on Wall Street, a mother, a playwright, a novelist, a filmmaker, a critical theorist, a teacher. She's currently doing a visiting professorship at the University of Minnesota in their American Indian Studies program. Her numerous, and I do mean numerous, scholarly and writerly contributions to American Indian Studies as we know it run the gamut from short fiction published in anthologies and literary journals, and that's the way I first met Leanne, through her short story, Moccasins Don't Have High Heels, to plays produced for stage and radio, most famously Indian Radio Days, produced with Wagon Burner Theater, to her award-winning novel, Shell Shaker, to the paradigm-shifting critical essays, one of which is called my favorite essay, The Story of America, a Tribalography, and to incisive documentary filmmaking like the project she just finished in conjunction with PBS and Native American Public Television in Cherokee, North Carolina, and even beyond. Leanne publishes in every genre, in multiple venues. She is truly a loud and persistent voice for American Indian people. She's won numerous awards, including an American Book Award and the WordCraft Circle Writer of the Year Award for Shell Shaker. And it's just impossible for me to list all of the things that she's done here and to describe all of her accomplishments. But I can truthfully say that she serves as an important mentor and friend to Native people, Native writers, Native scholars, and just regular Native folk all over North America. So before I start to gush, I want to just ask you to give a warm welcome to Leanne Howe.
Thank you. I'm always embarrassed. I don't know why. When I'm introduced, I always think, I don't recognize that at all. I don't think that's right. But it is a great honor for me to be here in Lansing, Michigan, and at Michigan State University. And I want to thank Malia Powell very much for inviting me, and for Patrick LeBeau and WordCraft Circle and the RAC and just the university at large for having me here. It's been a wonderful couple of days meeting students and visiting with faculty. Great faculty members here at the university. So thank you very much for having me read in your series. I started writing, and Patrick reminded me that he and I met at least over 10 years ago when I was working on Shell Shaker. This took a long time to write and research. And like Malia was saying, when to introduce someone that you know is difficult, and to write about your own tribe is also, I think, enormously difficult because it's something you know, and then yet something is that you don't know. There are things that you don't know. So I took about 10 years. Five of those years were spent in researching libraries, looking at texts that were collected by Cyrus Byington concerning the language and the language transitions that took place over a 100-year period when he was working, or really 60 years, working on our so-called dictionary. And a couple of NEH fellowships, and I worked at the Newberry Library, and then I worked in Mississippi looking at what's their C-13A files, which were the French colonial records, to write this book about my community. And yet it is a work of fiction, but most of the historical sections in Shellshaker are accurate as to the time and in the events that they took place. When I began working on Shellshaker, I thought I was going to write a historical novel, and yet the 18th century seemed very much to me like a contemporary story. The events that shaped our Civil War, the Choctaw Civil War, and being squeezed by the British and to the east and the north, and from the south around New Orleans from the French, that vice that was really problematic for the Choctaw people in the 18th century is very much, in my opinion, like the situation we have today, the contemporary situation where tribes are being squeezed by the federal government on one side and squeezed by the corporations on the other side. So Choctaw people are still maintaining this vice. And so I felt like these two time periods really spoke to each other, at least in the story that I wanted to tell. So I thought I would read a little bit from the novel from different points of view. I also teach creative writing in alternating years, and so I talk a lot to students about point of view. So for many of you who teach writing, and you know what I'm talking about, how to capture a character's voice and then stay true to that point of view throughout a short story, or in this case, chapter. So I'm going to read from about three different points of view in different time periods. The novel really opens with the first chapter, Blood Sacrifice. And when I first started reading from this chapter, of course it was before September 11th, and our culture, American culture, has become such a rights response, rights culture, as opposed to a responsibility, responsibility we have to each other. So students used to say, I just can't believe that she would sacrifice herself in this first chapter and let herself be killed. This character named Shakbatina allows herself to be killed because it's her responsibility to make peace between two communities, the Choctaw and the Chickasaw community. After September 11th, and after I was reading around the country, because the novel came out in October of that year, and students had seen and witnessed their own people in their own communities, the firemen, the police, sacrifice themselves for their community. People really stopped asking me about what a community will do, what sacrifices people will make on behalf of the whole. And so this is really what happens in the first chapter. Her name is Shakbatina, and her daughter, Annaletta, has been wrongly accused of murdering a woman from the Chickasaw community, the Red Fox Town, Red Fox Village. And so this is told from her point of view in 1738. And the Choctaws continued to practice this kind of sacrifice into the 20th century. And I'll talk a little bit about that. I'm working on the new novel called Miko Kings. It's a Choctaw baseball story, and it opens again in a similar way, but I brought a little excerpt from a real event and talk a little bit about that. But so this is from Shakopee's point of view on the day of her death. After carting the last basket of smoked meat to the Red Fox women in my yard, I lug pots of cool water from the Oxbow Pond for them to wash their hands in. This is my final lesson to my daughters, how to make enchilada hospitality. In this case, how to host gangs. Finally, I go to find a comfortable seat away from everyone. I want to be alone with my thoughts. I find a pale, wild onion pushing up through the dirt. Narrow and bent, it is the last of its kind this season, and I'm down to my own oneself too, so I pull it up and bite into it. Pungent and tough, the onion kisses my tongue, the taste curls my lips into a smile. I turn toward the cypress trees. Watch the light cap them in blazing reds and yellows. The forest breathes heavily around me. At sunsets, the bluebirds chitter in the tops of trees. People and things I've forgotten come rushing back to me. Grandmothers planting corn, making pots, cutting canes for baskets, scraping hides, reciting morning prayers, singing sleep to tired children. I long to have lived to see my own grandchildren, but this is not meant to be. I brush the dirt off my hands, and it seems to me that an entirely different woman danced beneath these trees with my husband Kui Chito so many years ago. In those days, my hair streamed down my back and made a cape over my arms. Now it's thin and stringy, like a starving dog's. The effects of the disease. The night we met, I wore a short deerskin dress fastened around my breast that left my buttocks exposed. At that time, it was fashionable for young girls to flaunt themselves that way. I felt beautiful when I stepped on to the dance grounds. There were so many dancers that night, I had to strain to hear the singers above the hundreds of dancers. When Kui Chito walked across my mother's yard and led me in the pleasure dance, I quit listening to the song and thought about him as a potential husband. I noticed him two seasons before, but decided he wasn't much. Too bony. He was already making children with an older woman from Yazoo Town. I thought he wasn't a good enough hunter to support two families. But that night, I changed my mind. He seemed so mysterious and strange. He held my hand so tightly during the last dance that the juice of his palms crawled up my arms and entered my mouth like a sweet vapor. Swallowing, I tasted love. Kui Chito was a warrior from the Imalashka, the war clan. Since there were no rules against multiple marriages, I moved him into my mother's house. Within a season, my belly swelled in contentment. Analetta was born, followed by Neshoba and Heya. The next 20 years, he lived and hunted around our territory, providing meat and hides for us. And it seems Kui Chito tethered my heart to his skinny bones, and there I remain. I stretch my legs. They still ache from the English Okla disease. When all the sick and dying were placed in sweat tents, I prayed to the disease to kill me, prayed that my relatives would abandon me, prayed to the fire to smother me. After I recovered, I asked Neshoba to put Kui Chito's things outside the door of my cabin. He picked them up and never returned to my bed. He understood that I couldn't bear to have him look at the disease under my skirt. until the catastrophe at the Red Fox Village. I hadn't known why I lived and others died. Now it's clear to me, I am to be the first warrior killed in battle against the Red Fox. Red Shoes and the English Okla must be planning to attack our town. Suddenly I realize there's so little time left. I have so much to do. When I reach my cabin, Haya is crying, gulping sobs. I pull her to me and tell her that she can close her eyes if she wants, or Neshoba will take her away before it happens. You can't go, Mother, she says in a pleading voice. I will take Annaletta's place in the blood revenge. Chiishkia Pela, help me, Mother. Nothing good will come of me after you're gone. I blame myself for Haya's nervousness. Before I had realized I was making another baby, I'd eaten too much rabbit. Too much rabbit makes a child twitch. It can't be helped now, all these rules for making babies. Too much deer, and you bring a child who runs away. Too much big cat, and you bring a child who turns assassin. I hope my girls remember all the rules. I put my head on Haya's shoulder. We've been through this before. All the reasons have been discussed. I try to comfort her. I tell her that she must understand she cannot stop what is coming. If I do what you ask, what will your uncle or your father think of me? I say. I gave you life, now I must go first. Annaletta and Neshoba and your aunts will look after you. You will never be alone. I motion for my second daughter, Neshoba, to come. Quick, quickly, while I still have strength. When she reaches us, I give Grandmother Stone to Neshoba. Take Haya into the forest, I say, and do not return until night has come. Then I kneel down and cradle my baby. Although Haya is no longer an infant, I still think of her that way because she is my youngest. I push the hair out of her eyes and kiss her again, inhaling her innocent breath. Then I give her to Neshoba. Haya begins to weep, but her sister takes her by the hand, and I watch them disappear through a canebrake. I want to run after them, touch them one more time, but I don't dare. I might yield. What I am, my essence will live inside my daughters. Next, I speak softly to Annaletta. Tell her to use all the skills I have taught her. Ask our friend Jean-Baptiste Bienville to fight Red Shoes and the English Okla. Bienville hates them as much as we do. I hold her for the longest time, and she promises to fulfill her obligations. Finally, I enter my cabin to remove my sticky work dress and prepare myself. I massage the swell of pockmarks on my sagging breasts. My arms are full of flesh and heavy as porous wood. The epidemic has chewed me to pieces. After today, I will be through with pain. I pull on my white deerskin dress and fasten the black and white porcupine sash across my shoulder like a shield. I rub my fingers over the threads and feel strangely calm. At last, I understand why Onatema was so angry at me all those years ago. I was born into a peace clan, but in my heart, I have always chosen a weapon. It is the reason I was attracted to the warrior Ilpentabi and tried to imitate his war dance. The reason why my first instincts were to wipe out the English Okla for bringing us disease. Why I now seek revenge. I decide that as my final gesture, I will show the people my true self. After all, I am a descendant of two powerful ancestors, grandmother of birds and Tuscaloosa. I dig around in my basket and find a pot of vermilion. Plunging two fingers in the paint, I mark my cheeks and spread the vermilion over my chin and down my neck the old-fashioned way Ilpentabi once stained his face. When I finish, I whoop, Tushkapana, a warrior's death cry. Then I hiss the words, Grandmother, do you see me? I will make the peace for you, but in my heart, I want a war. When I walk out of my cabin, some of the Enchilada women put on a face of stone to hide their surprise. Others look down and squint at their hands, but clearly they understand. Dressed in white, with my face painted red, I have split myself in two. My message to my people is that we must fight to survive. Next, I address the Red Fox Clan in my yard. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Cui Chito standing next to my brother. So, he could not stay away. Like a warrior controlling my fear, I sing my last song. Headman of the horse flies, my face is painted so you cannot see me. You'll see my tracks and cry too late. Headman of the horse flies, my face is painted so you cannot see me. Too late, headman. You cannot stop what is coming. The Choctaws of Yen Abbeytown erupt in laughter at my insulting song. No one from the Red Fox Village smiles. I look at Cui Chito and he beams with affection, nods his approval, and I continue. Headman of the horse flies, my face is painted so you cannot see me. I am the Shell Shaker, a descendant of grandmother of birds and Tuscaloosa. The actions I take honor them both. I am standing in for my first daughter, Annaletta, to make the peace. Iti la Ichi, autumnal equinox, on your day when I sing this song, you will make things even. The Red Fox politely accept my death in exchange for Annaletta's life and agree that there will be no war between the Choctaws and Chickasaws. In the presence of my family and all the people gathered in my yard, I stretch out on a log, face down, close my eyes, and pray for courage. As is the custom, a relative of the Red Fox victim carries out the execution. A one-eyed elder named Imatabi steps forward slowly with his war club. For the longest time, I hear him speak gentle words to the people, asking that the path be wiped clean between our two tribes. Then there is silence. I suck in my breath. I feel an icy, hot explosion in my head, deafening. Blood gurgles from my mouth, my hands spring to my head involuntarily. Blood is seeping out of my head, and flecks of bone are strewn through my hair. My arms jerk wildly like a wounded bird trying to fly away as the old man hits me again. I sense movement all around. Maybe Cui Chito angrily knocks the man away. I feel my body twitch, perhaps someone turns me over. I can no longer see. My head is unraveling. In that last moment, I have the burning desire to live and cling to the body. It is lean and compact. Cui Chito. Ha! He is here. I can feel him saying, give it up. I gasp for air and have no fear. I feel myself growing younger in this place. I grieve for my daughters when I hear their rhythmic wailings. I grieve for the red raw faces, teeth, eyes, cheeks, and black-haired people. I grieve for the seven grandmothers dancing in the distance as they shrink to almost nothing, then reappear as a flock of multicolored birds just beyond my reach. An unknown language floats around me. Each word is an old code that I must decipher. Suddenly there are streaks of white, and the delicious scent of tobacco fills the air as the spirit of an animal appears. big mother porcupine walks into view and takes me by the hand. I open my mouth to speak, but my thoughts escape into the wind. And that's a little bit from Shakyamuni's point of view in chapter 1. And this sacrifice that she makes returns, is a reoccurring theme throughout the novel. And that event, coupled with Red Shoes, who is a Choctaw war chief at the time, really set up the action in that time period. And I'm going to read just a little bit from Audibility's point of view in chapter 2. And it's set in 1991. And it's juxtaposed against these two events. And this chapter is called The Will to Power. And our the Choctaw headquarters for the nation are in Durant, Oklahoma. So the contemporary sections are set in Durant, Oklahoma. And then the historical sections are in Mississippi, the eastern part of Mississippi, where my family originated from in Kemper County. And we've been in Oklahoma since about 1832. Audibility sits on the side of her twin bed in the small upstairs bedroom of the house where she was born. At 4 a.m., the house is warm as wool and peopled with aunts and uncles, rabbits, ghosts of rabbits, and other relatives. The house was built over a century ago on the edge of town, the area now known as Old Durant. Old Durant stopped narrating to the Choctaws after the whites took over the town in 1907, statehood for Oklahoma. The spirits moved away, shed their skin that bound land and people together. Now they've returned, pulling stars down from the sky, causing a 50-mile-long prairie fire. From the Mineral Bayou Bridge in Durant to the outskirts of Hugo, Oklahoma, all the land along Highway 70 is seared black like a piece of burnt toast. It's a sign. They've come back to pick a fight. Otis' family knows nothing of the red fire that rage across the town, barely missing them. They can't hear the tormented cries of the farmers and merchants who are watching their properties go up in flames. They don't know about the Bokchita minister who chokes to death on smoke and soot, trying to save his church named Radiance is Accomplished. They've been rocked to sleep with all the other Indians by the powerful medicine of Itilaichi. It happens that way sometimes when the earth shifts and day and night are in perfect balance. Indians have all the luck. But Otter doesn't feel lucky. After working all day Saturday, she rushed home and locked herself in her bedroom. At midnight, she showered. 2 hours later, she showered again at 4 a.m. She's given up her ceaseless to-ing and fro-ing, her chronic hunger for water. She isn't sick. She isn't mad, dazed. She eats the room with her stare until the furniture, her clothes, even the cool silver and turquoise dots of her bedroom wallpaper are consumed. She's been waiting for something to happen, and at last it does. Out of the nothingness, a spirit emerges. A shell shaker appears for Otta. Shh, 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 shh. Otta watches the spirit woman with turtle shells strapped to her ankles. She's big-breasted and wears a deerskin dress bloodied at the neck and hem. Smoke rises from the turtle shells and forms a constellation on the ceiling. Otta knows the dance. Every spring, she shakes shells with other Indian women in southeastern Oklahoma. Although most women now recycle evaporated milk cans in the place of turtle shells, the dance still spiritually reconnects the earth and Indian people during green corn time. But this shell shaker song is different. It stirs an older memory coming to life inside her. Shh, shh, shh. Otta sees herself with hundreds of shell shakers around an ancient fire, a small woman with a scar on her cheek, whom she believes to be her younger sister, is next to her. Otta laughs and gossips with her sister between dances. Suddenly they grab the hands of a warrior making mud pies on the top of Naniwaya. They lead the warrior around the fire like a prize, smiling and cajoling, but finally they push him into the blistering flames. When she blinks, her room returns to normal, a comfort zone where she can retreat from the present. In the bookcase, she stores her dissertation copies, history books, family pictures, and a powder blue phonograph stacked with Motown's greatest hit singles, all 45s. She's even kept the black velvet painting of Elvis she bought at a state fair. Her bed still wears the quilts her aunts Dolores and Dovey Love made for her. They cross the usual Choctaw designs, the eye of friendship, the sunburst, and the coil snake that represent the power of the people to subdue their enemies. All memories she wants to cherish. Otta's hands tremble as she smooths her tangled wet hair. She coughs and realizes the entire room is filled with smoke. She opens the window and the sky is waking up gray. She sees her Uncle Isaac in the backyard talking with a group of Indian men about last night's fire. So the whole world is smoky. Good, she doesn't want to be in this alone. She crawls into bed. It's 6 a.m. Sunday morning. She clings to her pillow and almost sleeps. Outside, an ambulance drowns out the men's conversation. She tries to focus on what the shell shaker said, but instead hears a child's voice crying inside her, "Chi'ishki apela, mother, help me." At last, she does remember yesterday. His bulging eyes, his knife at her throat, and her own legs kicking up a storm. That's a little bit from Otta Billy's point of view in chapter 2. What she finally remembers and comes to terms with is that she was raped by the chief of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma the day before. And by the end of chapter 2, he is assassinated. And those two events, his assassination and Shakopee and the events that shape Red Shoes, those two things really, really are pivotal in the novel unfolding. The rest of the book really tries to solve the assassination of Red Shoes. And he was a war chief who was assassinated, and that really, his actions, he became what we call a Wasano, a bloodsucker, or someone who's greedy or feeds off his own people. And I'm kind of interested in the dynamics of power, what happens to communities, and what happened in the past for the Choctaw community and our own Civil War over greed. And so that's kind of what I was working on in the text. And so from all these different characters, all these Choctaws are telling the stories of these two events, and that kind of is what you need to know about the novel, I guess. I was going to read from my favorite character in the book, just a little snippet from his point of view, and it's Uncle Isaac, and he's modeled after my uncles. And on the back of the novel is a peanut mobile. And last year, Malia's class made me a peanut mobile that it still sits on my desk. When I was writing this book and kind of nervous about it, I read in Durant, Oklahoma, and I was really pretty nervous, and I was saying, well, you know, this contemporary situation is not really like this and so forth. And one old man who was in there says, oh, sure, just shut up and read. And but there was some students there who had made a peanut car. And they took me for a ride, and I got to ride in the parade and in the peanut mobile. And so I asked them if I could use that in the book and write this car into the story, and they said, oh, sure. So that's why there's a peanut mobile on the back of the book. And it kind of relates a little bit to the chapter I'm going to read called Chalk Tough. And there's also something else I should have said about Choctaws is that we're braggarts. And so Uncle Isaac, who's like my a compilation of my own uncles, is kind of a braggart in the story. So this is a little bit from his point of view. It's a few days after the assassination of the chief. Life is trying on Choctaws in Durant. Isaac Billy can't work. There's a gate in his head. Just as he feels he's on the verge of a supreme insight, he remembers yesterday and is stymied. 2,500 acres surrounding his hometown were burned up in a prairie fire in the wee hours of Sunday morning. A short time later, his niece, Otta Billy, was found on the floor next to the dead chief, her dress splattered with his blood, the murder weapon beside her. Much to his horror, his sister, Susan Billy, had confessed to the assassination, and currently every Choctaw in the county whose last name is Billy is being harassed by the police. Isaac's been accosted, too. At 8:30 this morning, a deputy from the sheriff's office presented him with a warrant to search his sister's garage. It seems the town's most treasured sculpture, Durant's Big Peanut, was stolen sometime after midnight. The gray, 4-foot-long, heavy cast aluminum statue was a gift to the city from a businessman who'd wanted there to be a downtown attraction that honored local peanut growers. The deputy claimed he was inned in speculation by members of the Peanut Growers Club that the sacred nut was hidden in the Billy garage. Of course, he found nothing, but the deputy told Isaac that he'd also issued an APB on the Choctaw student who turned a perfectly good 1976 Delta 88 into Durant's Big Peanut Mobile. Last summer, during the 4th of July parade, everyone thought those plaster casts of our peanut were pretty funny, glued on the car like wings. But with a peanut gone missing, well, no one's laughing now, Mr. Billy. Maybe you just need to find your sense of humor, Vernon, Isaac replied. Be careful, sir. Murder and mayhem are no laughing matter. College students, especially artists, are always troublemakers. I figure he probably knows who stole the peanut, or perhaps he took it for himself. But remember this, whoever steals art generally turns killer. Isaac just stared in disbelief. He'd known Vernon Klinkenbeard since he moved into town with his parents in 1980. The young deputy couldn't be much over 21. I'm due back at the county office, he said, adjusting his weapon, then himself, before speeding away in an unmarked car. Odd, mutters Isaac, now remembering the whole incident. Isaac looks at the sky, gray haze in the sky, and thinks it's sinking. He blames all this on the heavy satellites roving the world, announcing every 15 minutes that yesterday his sister confessed to murdering Choctaw Chief Redford McAllister. As he crosses the street to his newspaper office, a Winnebago almost runs him over. The woman... The woman behind the wheel slams on the brakes and jumps out of the vehicle. She runs toward him wearing a short, tight skirt, waving a microphone like a baton. You're Isaac Billy, are you not? She demands. A foreigner. Isaac stares at the woman whose hair is the color of sweet potatoes. I'm so sorry, sir. I'm not accustomed to driving on the wrong side of the street, she says, giggling. She tells him she's a reporter for CNN and wants to get a feed for the BBC. Typical Brit, he thinks. Feeding off the misery of Indians has always been their greatest joy. As she chatters on, he decides he is being interviewed by the Duchess of York. She's perky, smartly dressed. She has small white teeth and is kind of chubby, the way he likes younger women.
Yep.
She's Fergie, all right. He'd read somewhere that she's writing children's books. Things must be getting pretty tough in England if the Duchess of York has had to start freelancing. Isaac is amazed that the English are paying any attention to Choctaws. He understands why the Irish are interested in them. They have something in common, colonialism and potatoes. Choctaws never liked the English. Isaac believes they've always preferred les Français, better food. Even Dixon Durant, the town's founder, was half Choctaw, half French. Mr. Billy, just look into the camera and I'll give you a lead-in, commands the pretty Duchess. He clears his throat and prepares to respond. Sunday afternoon of the autumnal equinox, a holy day as far as Choctaws are concerned, 70-year-old Susan Billy confessed to the murder of Redford McAllister, chief of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, the fourth largest tribe by population in the United States. I'm talking with Isaac Billy, brother of the assassin. Sir, would it be fair to say that yesterday's savage-style assassination was an ancient Choctaw ritual, a kind of coup d'etat, so to speak, so your family can gain control of your tribe? Just like always, when he doesn't want to respond, Isaac feigns ignorance and performs like a John Wayne Indian, something he learned at boarding school. With a stubby, gnarled forefinger, he tilts his 10X Stetson back on his forehead, looks down at the ground kind of uncertain-like, kicks it like he's sorry, and pigeon speaks. Me? No English, he says, pausing innocently. Chi-ishki, u-chi-pisa ak-pulo, ahimud ala nakni, ina foka. Foka chichitok, which roughly means, your mother thought you were ugly, so she made you dress like a boy. Isaac wishes he hadn't said that, but knows she can't understand Choctaw. When she fires another question, pronouncing her proper British very loudly and slowly, as if he's deaf, Isaac decides she is a royal fool. Was there a love triangle between Chief Redford McAllister, Otta Billy, and your sister, Susan Billy? Is this murder perhaps the simple act of rage by an older woman jealous of her daughter? She shouts. Isaac explodes, but the words come out sounding like a whisper. Wasano, chisamata wasano. He smiles wide for the camera, tips his white cowboy hat, and turns his back, calling someone a horsefly or blood sucker is a terrible insult to a Choctaw. But he sighs deeply. The English are used to being for a whole lot of reasons, and if I would have let him, he would have taken over the novel and told the story all the way through by himself. And I just have time, I think, for just a couple of snippets. The person that was most important to me while I was doing historic research, and I love to think about, was Red Shoes and what happened to him. He was killed the night of the summer solstice in 1747, when the sun had gone down. And Choctaws wouldn't do this in front of the sun because the sun we revere that power. And so they waited until almost midnight, and his head was taken, and his body was set on fire. And this was a huge event. And because of his reputation, you have to remember that not only the British were writing about him, but the French were writing both, and the Spanish, in all three colonial documents, 10 years after his death, his name still raises fear in both the hearts of the Brits and in the French. And so they, for 10 years, they're writing about this warrior. and his effect on them. So I was also taken with him as a character, as someone real in our history, but also someone and trying to understand his motivations. So this chapter, from his point of view, in his voice, is the day of his death. Hashkohenkosh is the Choctaw word for heart of panther, and it means June. It's our word for June, or that time of the year. So I'll just read just a little bit of that, and then if you have any questions, I'd be happy to talk about writing and the craft of fiction, or Choctaws in general, or something. So, okay. I have carried the severed heads of the three Falanche Okla for months. Rot so strong, our unwashed bodies and the putrefying carcasses we haul of our own felled Ixa brothers cause the air around us to thicken with flies. As expected, an emissary from the nearby village arrives at our temporary camp. Her long shadow tells time. This will be a drawn-out day. She has a fierce appearance mixed with wild sorrow. She stares at us for a moment, then makes a step forward. If my Ixa brother, Imataha Huskusi, hasn't been here with the English Okla trades goods, we're done for. They will surely turn us away. We cannot bargain for their support with empty baskets. A knot of warriors appears from behind the canebrake to support their emissary. A gaunt man with half an arm gone begins talking. The woman continues looking straight ahead, but seems to be agreeing with him. I am bitterly offended. People once thought I was the Imataha Chito, the greatest war leader, and they would sing my praises as I walked into the councils of the Natchez, Alabama, Chattas, Tallapoosas, and Abiecas. Now I must hide myself among my warriors like a starving dog. The one-armed leader moves with grotesque jerks. We Shiacha, he keeps repeating, he wants us to clear out. No pack trains have been through here, and we are not welcome. There is no food. Their corn was burned last month by a town of warriors on the side of Falanche Okla. He says they await their new trading partners, the people from Yan Abbey Town, who will provide them with corn and beans in exchange for information. He says they desire peace. I can see the cage of his ribs moving in and out. His mouth is wide open, and it gives him an eerie, ravenous appearance, as if he wants to swallow our camp. He says Yan Abbey Town people will not like it if we are here when they arrive. He must be shouting, but he falls back suddenly and a helper catches him. Above, a black smoke cloud dents the blue sky, but I do not see the fire. The sunlight is thin. Unripened peaches fall from the trees and break my concentration. A bad sign. I will not wait for another. Stinking of excrement and sweat, I step through the crowd to address the speaker. Only the hands of a killer do not tire, I say. Here are the killed by me. I toss the three Falanche Okla heads at his feet. Old friends, I say, your new friends. I pause and let my actions tell the story of what kind of warrior I am. They must see that I will not hesitate to make the path run red with their puny blood. That one, I say, sliced at me with his bayonet, but he missed. I knocked off his head with my war club, the one I had chiseled from a cypress tree when I was but a child. Pointing to the second head with my lips, I explain how I caught my enemy unaware, then axed his shoulders and neck. His blood, I say, moves slowly across the land like the branch of a river. He staggered with his hanging head, then wheeled to the ground. The third head I hacked off quickly, but it lay in the mud for many days. A crow had dug out Falanchi's eyes and was yanking at a fat neck vein with its beak when I returned, saving me the trouble. I transformed Falanchi into something useful. Food for birds. After all, do not our traditions teach us that alive we are the consumers, in death we are the consumed? We are life everlasting, I say, earnestly touching my chest as I have seen the black robes do. To be consumed by a relative, the crow, it's a good end, huh? The one-armed leader is deliciously flawed, an egg of a man, breakable, I mean. I relish his anguish too much until the woman emissary begins chanting, Red Shoes, do you hear? Do you understand? Do not forget the dead are helping the living. The villages who have supported you, the Quichito, the Nushkobo, and West Abeka, will be totally destroyed after your head is broken. You are a dead man. The words have been spoken and attached themselves to you like leaves on trees. Blood, a gorget you wear, Red Shoes. You are the walking dead. And so that's a little bit from his point of view on the day of his death. And I'll finish up where I started with Shakopina. And she appears a couple more times in the novel. And even though I'm reading from her last words, I don't think it really gives that much away about the story. So this is from her final words. Now I must tell you what really happened. Since I had acquired the knowledge of splitting myself in two, I must be the one to tell the story of Itilaichi, who came back to Choctaw country when day and night were in perfect balance and Indians had all the luck. My story is an enormous undertaking, hundreds of years in the making until past and present collide into a single moment. Ada did hold the gun in her hand gently, as if it were inlaid with jewels. It was then that I slipped my hands in front of her hands, and together we struck a pose. The day was hers, all hers. But it was my day too. Nuklib Ishakachi, my breath is warm with passion. We Choctaws are Hatak Okla, Chut Achaya, Bilihon Ili Bila. Life everlasting. Hey, Kano, I am finished talking. Thank you. Thank you. As I said, I took a long time to do the story of the Choctaws, and I'm finishing up a novel this year called Minko Kings, which is a Choctaw baseball story, and it's set in 1910 through the about 1916, and then 1969, and I'm trying to. Those two time periods seem also very, very much in relationship to each other. So if there are any questions, I could talk about the baseball story. Or I brought a little newspaper clipping about Wate Nish, and he's a character. He was a real person, but it's also about what happens and how a community feels. So I thought I would read this, and it's from the Cleveland Plain Dealer from Saturday, August 14th, 1897. And it's it was in their sports section or whatever they were calling their sports section at the time. It's called This Card Should Draw. A remarkable story comes from Kansas City and is said to be true. Wate Nish, a member of the Choctaw tribe in Indian Territory, is under sentence to be shot next Monday. Meanwhile, Wate Nish plays baseball, and very good ball indeed, for he is a star player on the baseball team which upholds the honor of his tribe on the diamond. It was originally intended that he should be shot Saturday, which was the day the paper came out, but the governor of the Choctaw Nation is a man of tender heart and a rooter of the 33rd degree. Therefore, when he learned that to hold the execution on Saturday would interfere with a game that was to be played in Kansas City on that day, he postponed the interesting ceremony. Wate Nish appreciates the clemency of the executive very much, and on Saturday he will play the game of his life and death. No restraint is placed upon him. He runs bases, throws the ball with unerring skill. After the game, he will leave with the team for Tuskahoma and be shot in due and proper time on Monday afternoon. He killed another member of the tribe in a fight. And so this was in the paper. And in my novel, he is the uncle of Hope Little Leader, who also is a baseball player. And so the story really pivots around events of what happened both here and up through really World War I. The Choctaws were the first code talkers. Most of the baseball leagues that were playing in the late 1890s and through 1916 were disbanded because Choctaw men, and certainly all the other tribes, joined the service and went abroad. And we're the first, not very many people know this, but in World War I, the Choctaw served as code talkers. And my uncle in World War II was also a code talker, and in 1989 was awarded the French Medal, the French Cross, on behalf of all the Choctaw code talkers from World War I and World War II in a big ceremony. Slish Billy, my uncle, was the last surviving code talker at that time. So this is kind of what I'm working on now, is a story that encompasses these two time periods. And for me, again, it's very interesting. If there are any questions about writing or story, I'd be happy to answer questions. Yes. Well, most of the tribal people I know don't think that it's internally a very different way of thinking than what ethnographers and anthropologists write about those events as an outsider. So what to some may be secluded away is there's a whole lot of things that are going on within a community that might look like seclusion to one, but a day of rest or a week of rest to another. So I think those kinds of impurities have been wrongly wrongly categorized, if that makes any sense. And so there are a lot of things that our communities from the lower Mississippi Valley were swampland throughout the South, which means from the Mississippi River over into, even up into parts of Tennessee, a swampy land. And if the, let's say in the 18th century, it's crawling with alligators and all kinds of bear and various other animals, but lots of bear. And I've often thought about that. If you, and our communities are sedentary, they were towns that had been there, those daughter villages had been there forever. So if you think about it, with, you know, let's say 1,300 women at a time in large towns, in our large towns, that our blood is extremely powerful, and it also draws animals. So there's a reason for us being together and protected. That's the key. That's a key word, because wild animals are come around. That's one thing. And the second thing is that that is in our community. We have a saying and a word that kind of that means the power of women's speech. That at a particular time, even our spit is so powerful that it will kill a thing, meaning animal, and our voices, and even that the nook that comes out of us, out of breath and mind, is extremely powerful. And we want to protect our communities from that kind of power. So you really, when you're thinking about some of these things as an outsider to communities that you're not familiar with, it's good to really think about them in another way. And I had that experience myself. I lived in Jordan for a year, and what appeared to me as an outsider, as an American, on some of the practices that women do in those countries looks very different, looks sometimes offensive and different to an outsider than it does the meanings, the context to those people within that community. So those are the things I'd be careful of. And so in that particular chapter that Audis, that you're talking about, Auda is talking about that is so powerful that we can use our own blood as a source of protection. So that's why it's there. Yes. Well, I'm so happy you asked that. Actually, I have, I'm really lucky that I know that there are historians around the country that are teaching Shellshaker now in their history classes. And so I've actually gotten really good reviews from historians. And part of that is I spent a long time in battle with those folks. And so I had two NEH summer seminars led by historians for the Southeast. So, I mean, I've given a lot of papers, and so I'm kind of lucky in that regard. And so when the work has come out, I've really had a lot of good comments, and the book is used in teaching Southeastern history. So I'm actually kind of lucky. So thanks for asking. You know, after all the years of doing this, it's been a good relationship. So we are strange. Is that right? Fiction and history are strange bedfellows, I think. It's been good. My own community that I was also worried about has given the some of the best newspaper reviews have come out of Oklahoma. And so that's been really nice for me, because I worried that I would muck it up so much that my own community would drum me out of the tribe. And so that was very scary. And so far that hasn't happened. In fact, on Friday I'm going to Oklahoma for the literary festival, and so it's been a really good experience. And so those two things together were probably the thing I scared about. Oh, forget the historians. I was worried that my own community would kill me. I was like, you did, what did you say? You know that. So yeah, that was my, I was wringing my hands thinking, oh no, that's bad. So any other questions? Thank you. You've been a lovely audience.